Hey, this is Have You Heard About, a pop culture deep dive, and I'm your host, Massa. So thrilled to have Sarah Peterson on the pod today. She wrote one of my favorite books from the past year, Momfluenced, inside the maddening, picture-perfect world of mommy influencer culture, and is the writer behind Substack's In Pursuit of Clean Countertops. We get into all things momfluencing, from trad wives, our complicated parasocial relationships, the enormous impact they've had on our culture, and so much more. We'll be giving away a few copies of her incredible book, so make sure you're following us on Instagram at Have You Heard Podcast to learn more. Without further ado, here's my chat with Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
This is a real long time coming because we were supposed to do this, I think it was, I want to say like October of 2023.
Yeah, it was before the book came out, definitely.
It's amazing. It is so good. So you are the author of Momfluenced, Inside the Maddening Picture-Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. You also write about motherhood and feminism for Harper's Bazaar, In Style. You have a Substack that I subscribe to, highly recommend it, called In Pursuit of Clean Countertops. And we were supposed to do this podcast so long ago, and people in Canada will remember there was a point where for maybe kind of post-COVID, I want to say for 4 or 5 months, it was almost impossible to get children's Tylenol and Advil.
Yeah.
This is so crazy. I don't know how much Canadian news you guys get in the US or if you experience something like this, but I had my daughter at the time would have been probably 2. And childcare was super spotty. It was still COVID-y. And my kids were just always sick. And We were supposed to do the podcast. And then I was like, Sarah, I can't do this right now. Like, I can't even get Tylenol. And I don't even have childcare right now. So like, let's reschedule. And then I ended up not doing a podcast again for the longest time. And I got childcare in September. So the podcast is back because
a whole new world.
I know, it's amazing. So I just, first of all, want to thank you so much for coming onto the podcast after we were supposed to do this so long ago.
Oh my gosh, of course.
Can you tell us a little bit, so much of what you write about is around the motherhood and feminism piece and the intersection of it. Can you tell us about how you became interested in this, your own experience with momfluencing, if first in terms of following these momfluencer accounts and then kind of taking a more critical look at it?
Yeah. I mean, I first started thinking about feminism in like a visceral way once I had my first kid. You know, I had studied feminism. I had taken women's studies classes in college and grad school, but I don't think I ever felt like the blood and guts of it until having a kid and just feeling like I couldn't quite put my finger on why it all sort of felt like a scam, but I just walked around feeling like the system just doesn't feel right, like the system of institutional motherhood. And yeah, I just had a lot of rage, a lot of feelings to sort of sort through as a new mom. I also experienced postpartum depression, which I think was both chemical and also a reaction to sort of the mythology of motherhood I had consumed throughout my life leading up to motherhood and comparing
that. Is
that
more like in seeing your own mom mothering and fictional depictions of motherhood on TV or?
Totally, totally. And just like swallowing unquestioningly. That's
yes.
What I'm looking for. Yes.
Yes.
Just this idea that like, my life should follow a certain very gendered trajectory. Like I should fall in love with a man. I should have a baby. Like I never considered not being a mom.
Yeah.
Which I think is really not good. Do you know what I mean?
I do. Cause I was talking to you a little bit before we started recording and I was saying how so much of what you wrote about in your book, I personally was able to identify with. I have 3 kids. My first, and like my mom, we were immigrants. I immigrated to Canada from Iran when I was 5. And my parents were like real hands-off parents. Like it was, you know, they were just trying to survive, right? No one could speak English. We were here. Me and my brother could speak English. So we'd often have to like translate for them and navigate the world sort of for them. Yeah. And they were busy and they were young-ish when they had us, like in their early 20s. And a big part of me really appreciates the independence. And some of it sticks with me because I see in my own kids, sometimes I'm like, oh my God, you guys, like I was doing X, Y, and Z when I was 5 years old. What is happening? You know,
so right.
There's the motherhood that I absorbed wasn't necessarily like this one of like domestic bliss, but the parts of it that I appreciated was my mom kind of let us like fend for ourselves, which might be part of like, you know, the generation at the time, but
yeah.
How that manifested for me when I had my eldest daughter. I have three girls. So I had her in 2013. And when I tell you, I was like so out of my element, like not a maternal bone in my body. And so I used to watch this kid sleep to make sure that her little chest was rising, you know, and disinfecting the playground swing. And, and my foray into momfluencing was really in terms of following these early accounts, right? Like Instagram was really like still, but especially back then, it was most perfect feed, really beautiful. And I was like, okay, so I guess I need to buy this diaper bag and I need to do this. And it was a way of not being able to, you know, we're inundated with 1,000 decisions a day. And if I just copied what they would do, it made it easier. And then by the time I had my second kid 3 years later, didn't really care as much, kind of, I was disenchanted by the whole thing. And oh my, like, especially my kids are pretty spaced apart. By the time I had my third kid, April of 2020, best timing, I was just smack in the middle of COVID. I was 100% just kind of like really done with that whole thing. Is that similar to sort of like your trajectory with the momfluencing culture as well?
Yeah. I mean, I first started like following blogs before, you know, I started following them on Instagram. Yes. And I think it almost felt, instead of like grappling with my own existential angst about motherhood, like my own very complicated feelings about motherhood, and my own sort of, you know, I was dealing with some professional stuff. Like I was very unmoored. And instead of sort of grappling with that stuff, I think it was easier for me to latch onto these accounts and trick myself into suspending disbelief and believing that, you know, if I follow her travel tips or whatever, I will have more patience. Or if I take my kids to a strawberry patch, it will create core memories or whatever it is. Like,
yeah,
it was almost a way of disengaging from my interiority in sort of an alarming way. But yeah, for sure, I got increasingly jaded with this like fantasy as I continued to have kids. And by the time I had my third, I feel like I was completely...
I know.
Absolutely not.
100%. Do you think that we oftentimes mix up being a good mother with having the aesthetics of good motherhood, like the kind of traditional stuff that you would see? I know that when many of us think of momfluencing, we think of the white shaker perfect kitchen, the farmhouse sink, the marble, everything is white. Mm-hmm. You know, there's fresh flowers sitting somewhere. And, is that like our little brain's shortcut to being like, this is what good motherhood looks like. And to be a good mother, this is what you need to have.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I think motherhood has always been heavily aesthetic. And we've, you know, derived meaning from how it's been aestheticized, much more so than fatherhood, for example. I don't think, you know, sure, maybe if somebody were to say, like, imagine a good father, maybe you're thinking about like a guy throwing a baseball in the backyard.
Yeah.
But it's not as detailed and as powerful of an image by any means. And I also think we confuse good motherhood with like good consumerism. And that is no accident. Throughout history, you know, marketers have really deliberately encourage mothers to view their ability to shop well as both, you know, patriotic as being a good citizen and also being a good mother and raising the next generation of good citizens.
Well, and that piece is so interesting to me because I swear I had so many, I had pages of notes reading your book. And that was like upon my second read. And one of the things that I think I really got out of it was oftentimes when people will refer to momfluencing or just influencing in general, it's almost looked at as like, oh, it's frivolous. Oh, it's silly. It doesn't matter. Oh, it's just moms taking like these pretty photos and posting it for people to see. And the thing that you really draw upon is like, this is, we should be paying attention to it because one, it's big business. Mm-hmm. It like does a lot for the economy and it also shapes our culture. And you explain it as being almost like a fun house, mere reflection of our society reflected back to us. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's no surprise that the most financially lucrative accounts and the, you know, the accounts with the most, the biggest followings are those accounts that really adhere to whiteness, to traditional gender norms, to domesticity, to femininity. They really, in many cases, are super, super similar to renditions of motherhood taken from, you know, the late 19th century.
Yeah.
In, you know, the cult of domesticity. And I think it's such a powerful image, you know, both in the market sphere and in the domestic sphere, because it's really been codified for us by, not by other mothers, but by people who want to sell us stuff, by white men in power who want to maintain and uphold their power, by people who want to very clearly delineate who deserves protection and support and who does not. So I think the imagistic nature of Instagram momfluencer culture is really intrinsically tied to the imagistic nature of motherhood in general.
So at its, I really became so skeptical over momfluencing that, you know, I was really following very little. I don't even know if I was following any momfluencing accounts by the time my second kid came around. And I also feel like I was so bogged down in my own motherhood. I had a lot of similar career things that you had where everybody, I ended up being a stay-at-home mom and all my friends were like, out of everybody who decided, like you would have been the last person that we would have guessed would have done this. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was over for me being in Canada. The childcare piece was a big one for me. I felt really, and maybe because my parents left me to my own devices so early, I had like this hypersensitivity to like where I would leave my kid. Would the daycare be safe? Would the nanny be safe?
Yeah.
And like, I really struggled with that piece. So when I was reading your book, there was because you're American, a lot of the influencers I hadn't heard about in there. Like, I know you're one of your gateways to influencing, to momfluencing was it Taza?
Yeah. Naomi Taza? Davis. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had heard of Ballerina Farm and I had heard of like Rachel Hollis, of course, because she is, you know, girl, wash your face.
Uh-huh.
But the Canadian influencing pool is smaller. We have like way less of a population than you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's smaller, I feel like in some ways it's more dangerous in the sense that everybody is connected somehow and friends with each other. And I'm talking about like your cis, Caucasian, wealthy, attractive momfluencer where they're like, raise other women up. Mm-hmm. But the moms that they're raising up are exactly like them, you know?
Totally. Totally.
And so it becomes this echo chamber of influence where every individual influencer seems bigger than they are just because it's like this cool kind of group of women who continue to promote and like continue to talk about each other. And that can become like really toxic for the people that are following them. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask you, because I was so skeptical over it, but in reading your book, I was like, no, there is a good side. There is good stuff to get out of this. So at its worst, what does momfluencing look like? And at its best, what does momfluencing look like?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, at its worst, I would say it's women capitalizing on our desire to consume good moral maternal narratives. Basically, what they do is they weaponize, primarily white motherhood, the presumed morality of white motherhood. So they really fashion themselves as just a mom, mother first, mama to however many littles. Oh, yeah. It's always like the very first thing. So you go in thinking like, okay, she's a mom. And we've been trained to view mothers as selfless, as nurturing, as soft, as gentle, as unthreatening, as wanting what's best. And of course, what's best, I'm putting big scare quotes, is, you know, completely varies depending on person. But yeah, we go in with this mentality that like she's just a mom. And therefore, I think we're our guard is down.
Yeah.
And then this mom might, you know, her account might be very beautiful. It might feature just like lots of nature, lots of like floral infographics, lots of earth tones and pastels. So again, we're being sort of conditioned to view this as innocuous content. And it's really easy for these types of momfluencers to, for example, tag an organic mattress brand in one post and then write a really cryptic, vague post about, you know, doing research, just asking questions, you know, speaking truth to power. And this can really lead to some dark places. It can lead to, you know, QAnon conspiracy theories. It can lead to just blatant disinformation. I've seen some quote unquote free birthers write about how hospital births permanently severs the ideal mother-baby bond. Like really, really toxic stuff. It can lead to blatant white supremacist messaging. Yeah, so I would say that's the scariest corner,
yeah.
The sort of intersection between aesthetically unthreatening images and, you know, really dangerous, harmful messaging. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I think just any mother who doesn't fit into the quote unquote good mom box, any mother who's marginalized in any way is going to have, you know, an important viewpoint and is going to change the narrative, you know, in terms of like what we have been conditioned to view like an ideal mother is looking like. So yeah, like I want to, especially the mothers with most privilege, we should really be listening to these perspectives. Like, for a Black mother, for example, she's likely to be less preoccupied by feeling bad about like not using cloth diapers or whatever the case might be, because she has to have, you know, discussions with her like 4-year-old sons about police violence and brutality. So like we really, I think the best accounts provide much needed perspective. I think perspective can become very narrow, particularly the more privileged you are, you're worrying about far less significant things than the most marginalized mothers. So yeah, that was a long-winded answer. But yeah, I think just any account that challenges the status quo is
for sure. No, I think that's perfect. And that was such a great point in your book. And you did such a good point of highlighting the more like marginalized mom communities. And I especially loved there was a section on Indigenous motherhood. I think the account is actually called Indigenous Motherhood. Is it Andrea?
Yes, Andrea Landry. Andrea.
And, you know, and you also kind of advocated low-key gossip in your book, which I loved because gossip historically is used as like almost like a whisper network. It's a way for women to warn each other, or connect with each other, and to sort of build community. And you talked about on how on her Instagram, she used it as a tool to educate and help other Indigenous women navigate their own pregnancies and their own births, by saying like, avoid this hospital. Oh, I drove an hour out of my way to go here because, you know, they're not racist here. Of course, like there's so much. We in Canada, we like to pretend that there is like no racism. There's so much racism. It's like, come on, guys, like, let's be real here, you know?
Right.
It exists. And us pretending to be polite isn't actually a real thing. And so I loved that you brought that up. The other thing that I loved was that you talked a lot about the different types of momfluencers. So the wellness mama, we have a lot of boss babes. in Canada. Yeah. We were really deep in our Boss Babe momfluencing.
Oh, wow.
That's like our bread and butter is the Boss Babe slash kind of wellness.
Oh, yeah.
And we have a lot of, I'm in Vancouver. Vancouver is, have you ever been to Canada or to Vancouver?
I've been
before?
To Canada, but not Vancouver.
Okay. So like it's very West Coast. Mm. You know, it is super expensive here. It is very hard to live. It is like a ridiculous city for that. It's beautiful today. Right. Or 3 months of the year, we get like decent weather. But you get a lot of these, and we're small. So you get a lot of these momfluencers who were just exactly kind of the momfluencing prototype, rich, white. They kind of like all dress in like Lululemon.
Yep.
And, you know, they shop in the same boutiques and they're all always like amplifying each other's voices. And so you start to get so like, oh my God, like what else is there? Is there anything else? And they never acknowledge that there is like anything else out there. When you guys went through your George Floyd and, you know, COVID was happening, and I don't know, I'm not American, so I don't know what the shift in influencing felt like there or in momfluencing, but here, there was some pressure with these moms to now speak on these issues. So stop just amplifying the voices of women that look like you. Instead, try to amplify the voices of marginalized communities. And some people started doing that, not all, but a few, and some didn't. And I've noticed, and many people have noticed, that the people that were doing it have since stopped. And so what do you say about, like, you know, like the accountability that we should hold these influencers to when they're only amplifying voices that are just like their own? You know, what do they owe us in terms of this? But also, there's like a complicated question around when they are amplifying Indigenous voices or Black voices, they're asking other women to do the labor for them. And you cite Feminista Jones in your, am I pronouncing that right?
Yep.
And she calls it like Mammy 2.0,
right,
where
right.
we're now asking women in the BIPOC community to do the labor and work and to like educate the rest of, you know, the white woman. So what is the fine line here? What should we be expecting from our momfluencers, if anything at all?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I have so many answers to that question because it is such a complicated question. On the one hand, I don't think, just as we shouldn't look to, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow as like a source of political wisdom or medical advice, we shouldn't look to momfluencers for that either. But I do think we crave some sort of awareness that being, quote unquote, apolitical is not possible. That silence is a type of politicization.
And like in not saying anything, are you saying something?
Right. And I think, you know, the more complicated the world gets, the more we crave a sense of knowledge that these people were following and allowing into our, you know, into our lives. I mean, we're really allowing these strangers into our lives in meaningful and profound ways. We want to know that they're not anti-vaxxers and, you know, they're not Trump supporters. Yeah. And then, you know, I think you were bringing up sort of virtue signaling and talking about social justice issues for clout. And I immediately think of Coa Beck. I quoted her throughout, but she wrote a really great book called White Feminism and talks about sort of like brunch activism. You know, we had the Women's March here in, when was that? 2018? I can't even remember now. The pink pussy hat. And it was very much, you know, I did it too. We were all posting our, you know,
the future is female t-shirts that you talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. And we were posting our Women's March, like, you know, posters or whatever. And it's not to say that we didn't believe in, you know, what, you know, we didn't believe that Trump was bad and we were protesting for real reasons. But it is dicey when you are cherry picking sort of the social justicey moments of your life to share online, Yeah. And I think white women specifically need to be really self-aware and, more than anything, know that somebody has been doing activism in whatever it is you're, you know, just learning about. Somebody's been doing that work for years and years and years before you. And I think it's our job as white women to locate those people and just listen. And essentially say, like, how can we help? What is useful? You already know, you know, the lay of the land. And not in a way that's like, do the labor for me.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's great to, you know, come online and act as though you've discovered some core injustice that actually has been around for decades before you were aware of it.
Yeah. We had a lot of dissent during Freedom Convoy. Did you? I don't know if you guys got
was
a lot of
truck?
Freedom Convoy.
Is that
the truck
thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know vaguely about it.
Yeah. And it was interesting because around the time that it happened, I'm vaccinated. So I actually, our first trip out of here, like on a plane in a couple of years, was we had gone to Laguna Beach
California. Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess it's like the place we were staying was, we were at the Montage, and when we were telling everyone, like we were telling the American like servers and hostess and whoever we were talking to, we were like, in Canada, there's like the Freedom Convoy right now. And they were like, yeah, it's great. And I'm like, what? Like, I don't think they understood that because it had the word freedom in it, like it's, you know, I think conservatives do a really great job, like how Trump does, of being like, and it's tremendous, and Hillary's a crook. You know, there's so much interesting language being used. So when they brand something as Freedom Convoy, people that maybe don't live in these spaces, like they're not understanding that, like, no, it's not a good thing. Yeah. And there was a lot of momfluencers who are these like traditional, you know, types, kind of like more, I would say we're not like steeped in like trad wife type momfluencers here. And in fact, when I bring trad wives up on my Instagram or when I podcast about it, most people here are like, oh, what is that? So we can kind of get into the definition of that. But we have, I'd say, you know, 40 minutes outside of Vancouver, we have a lot of farmland. Mm-hmm. And so you get a lot of these wives that are kind of like a mini Rachel Parcell, you know, like they live in their mansion and things, and the very conservative values. And these moms were promoting, and they agreed quite a bit with Freedom Convoy, and their followers, they have hundreds of thousands of followers, people felt gutted because they did not see the signs that this is a conservative person who is going to be anti-vax. They don't believe in COVID. They're going to vote for the person who best represents them, not the best person who represents us all. And there's an author of the, it's like a vegan cookbook called Oh, She Glows, and she has an account. Her name's Angela Lydon. And she came out as super pro-Freedom Convoy, and people felt so betrayed. And I felt like that was so interesting because we've developed such a strong parasocial relationship with these people. I think in part because our communities feel really fragmented these days. I don't know if you feel like that. You're in New Hampshire, right? I don't know what it's like there, but in Vancouver, people really keep to themselves. It's hard to like kind of break into like make new friends unless you're a really outgoing, extroverted person, which a lot of people are just not.
Yeah.
And so, you know, instead of finding these real life relationships, we tend to latch on to these parasocial ones. And then when they do something that maybe doesn't align with our values and how we feel, it's like a guttural reaction to that.
Yeah.
People were big mad over that.
Yeah.
Right? So, with the trad wives, if you can give us a definition, because people are always like, what is a trad wife? And, you know, and also how can they be trad wives if they're making all this money by like making sourdough? That part I myself don't understand. So,
totally. I mean, the simplest definition is just somebody who adheres to traditional gender norms. So trad is short for traditional. But she might be a stay-at-home mom of three driving a minivan and prioritizing making her husband a sandwich when he gets home, or she might be like full on, you know, I believe the man is the leader and makes the household decisions. And, you know, I never withhold sex, like all sorts of, you know, obedience, submission are, you know, at the top of the trad wife mission statement, I guess. So yeah, they might just look like typical suburban housewives, or they might look like they've been plucked from like a 19th century painting in gingham and calico and whatever. But what's the second half of your question? How can they be trad if they're making money? I mean, this is really the central oxymoron for trad public figures, because it's like, if the woman's job is to be rooted in the domestic sphere and not worry about the money and not involve herself in the market sphere, then how does she justify going on Instagram, you know, getting involved in sponsorship deals, using affiliate links to earn money? And some ways they get around this is by saying that God has led them to do this. A lot of them are evangelical Christian. And so they'll say, yeah, God has placed me here to educate other women about how to be godly wives, to reject feminism, to embrace femininity. And they really tie it to this larger mission. And I think a lot of Mormon trad wives get around this, you know, find this loophole in terms of like journaling and storytelling is like a huge part of their faith. They're raised to journal, to scrapbook, to record events for posterity. And they're also raised, Mormon women, to, you know, maintain their bodies as a reflection of Christ and maintain their homes as a reflection of their devotion to Christ. And so they're, you know, taught to share their lives, and they're also taught to keep themselves immaculate and their homes immaculate. So it's kind of a perfect marriage of those things on Instagram.
That's why we have so many Mormon influencers, is because they're taking what they learned in the church and then they're performing it for like a public sphere, essentially.
Totally. And they're also, you know, if their lives look beautiful, it's a way of proselytizing their faith, you know, like,
yeah,
maybe the average agnostic is scrolling through accounts and thinking to herself, like, maybe I should look into Mormonism because it looks pretty great. Like, even if the momfluencer in question is not explicitly trying to convert her followers, just her presence alone might do the work for them.
Yeah. I've actually never in my life, I'm 42, I've never met a Mormon person. Like, I don't know. I think we only have, I was reading your book and I'm like, how do I not know anyone Mormon? This is what, like, there has, I have to know someone. And I ended up Googling it. I think we only have like 9 Mormon temples in all of Canada.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think we have some, and there's definitely some overlap with like Mennonites and Jehovah's Witness and that type of thing. But they exist. Of course we have Mormons here. They're fewer and far between, and probably especially in a place like Vancouver.
Right.
We have this, a bit of the trad wife thing. We don't have it in like the extreme sense where it's like they're really deferential to their husbands, at least not from what I see. And there's less of like the homestead movement here. Yeah. But because I feel like in some ways, I hate saying this, but I feel like Canada sometimes is like a little bit like the whatever the States is doing, we're kind of like next up. And so when I see these accounts of like Nara Smith and things on TikTok, who I think is hilarious, who's making like the little cereal. You know, it's like more like I'm proud of myself for just getting my kids to pour their own cereal. So it's like, I think it's amazing if you're going to do that and you want to spend your time that way. Like, that's great. I could never, but that's awesome if that's kind of what you want to do. But we don't necessarily have it in the same way you guys do, but that doesn't mean that it's not coming. And I thought you kind of touched on this before, is that these moms have so much like underlying power as well, because within these recipes of sourdough and making homemade Play-Doh with their kids, they are sometimes alluding to things like, and we have to save our children. And you know what I mean? Like, save them from what?
Yeah.
Or they're, you know, like, oh, and I'm going to do, before I vaccinate my kid, I'm going to read the Dr. Sears book on vaccinations, which, by the way, I did when I've had my first kid, because I was like, so what do I do? What do I do? Of course, I know. All the things of first-time moms that, man, I feel for you guys, the first-time moms.
I know.
I wouldn't want to do that again. But they, because their aesthetic is so beautiful, they're able to really cleverly bury these more dangerous messages in their beautiful grid. And then the other part that I thought was so interesting is, you know, you talked about how white nationalism values motherhood in a traditional sense, whereas our own society is like, F the moms, like, we don't, you know, we're going to pretend to care about you, but we don't actually, because there's no systemic resources for you. It's hard to find childcare. It's hard to, you know, there's no community. It's like, it's getting more difficult.
Yep.
Whereas the white nationalists are like, have as many kids as possible, teach them our values, and, you know, and being a good mother is such an important thing. And so I think you can start to see the veil lift on why these trad moms kind of gravitate towards towards this. It's because in a society that doesn't value motherhood, they're finding a space that in their own way does, which is like mind-blowing to me to read that.
It's so distressing because motherhood is so disenfranchised in so many ways. I just think about, you know, going to a dinner party and say your work is rooted in, you know, caring for your home and your kids, and that's your job. If you're asked at a dinner party, what do you do? And you say, I'm a mom, you're like, it's like an immediate dismissal. You know what I mean? Like, there's no cultural cachet. You're not going to get a follow-up question. And I think that's really harmful. I think, again, it has to do with capitalism and the fact that we are taught to value and respect professions that make the most money. But if you are a stay-at-home mother looking for validation, craving some sort of outlet, whether it's, you know, political, creative, and you're looking for a chance to be seen as somebody with a point of view, as somebody with expertise, the white nationalists are going to offer you the illusion of power. But, you know, it ends with a door slammed in your face. Like, it's not 100%. Real power.
No.
But
you're the lowest on the totem pole still.
Right.
Like,
and like, your access to power depends on you buying into a narrative of subservience and, you know, inferiority. So
exactly.
Not a great trade.
No, and you also talk a lot about the performance of motherhood, which I feel like that's a new way that we speak about mothering, is the performance aspect of it. And when I was reading it, I was like, of course, all these momfluencers, it is a performance, because they are curating and they're putting their lives on Instagram or on TikTok or wherever in a way that we want to see. But you take it one step further and you say, actually, no, we're all performing, right? Like, motherhood is just generally a performance. If you're a mother, you're performing. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I would broaden that even further and say all human beings are performing all the time, because we're social creatures with, you know, consciousness. Like, we perform to our kids when we trot out some sort of gentle parenting script, even though we really feel like throwing a plate against the wall. We perform at preschool drop-off when our kid is having a meltdown and we mask our shame and embarrassment while we're getting them into the car. We're different people with our friends than we are with our spouses. We're different people with our parents than we are with our doctors. So the list just goes on and on and on. But when we're on social media, there's a whole other layer of performance, because our performance of self is not just for our sister or our child or the doctor or whoever. It's for however many followers you have. I don't think there's any such thing as authenticity in the true sense of the word on social media, because there's just several layers of performance that goes into posting or sharing on social media. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, or it necessarily means that we're not sharing a true part of ourselves, but we can never share our full selves. I don't think.
Yeah. You talk about it so cleverly as like building the mythology of our own motherhood, which I was like, oh yeah, like that is, you know? So I had sort of said to you before we started recording, like reading the book, I think anyone reading it will have so many moments where they're like, this is putting into words how I've been feeling for so long, but you were clever enough to like write it down for us and make sense of it for us, which I really appreciated. There is, you know how there used to be the GOMI website, Get Off My Internet?
Yes, yes.
It was a super harsh website.
Wait, it's gone
now.
Oh, I think so.
No, I think it is gone. I believe it's gone because I think I looked for it once and years ago and I was like, oh, I don't know where it is. But I feel like Reddit's replaced it. Is it still there?
No, it's still there.
It's still there.
I think it's still there.
Is it still there?
I'm seeing it's GOMI blog. Yeah. Wait.
Oh, is it still there?
I think it's still there.
I never hear about it anymore.
No, totally. I feel like they've moved over to like BlogSnark.
They're on like Reddit or
something.
Yeah,
that's what I mean.
At least in Canada. Yeah, we're on Reddit. But GOMI was never like a huge thing here. GOMI was and is harsh, right? Like it is the mean older sister of Reddit, you know? Like she's jaded. She's been through some things. And an interesting thing that happened here about a month or so ago is there's one of the most famous Canadian influencers. Her name is Jillian Harris. She kind of is more in like Boss Babe wellness
space. She was on The Bachelor.
Yes, of course. So you would have heard of her.
And she was on HGTV.
She did a show called Love It or List It for a couple of years. She's not, and this is an interesting thing because she has since come out and said, like, I was never an interior designer. Like, I didn't go to school for this. I kind of faked it till I made it. Like, she actually said this on a podcast. I think the podcast was like Cat and Nat. It's a mom sort of podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And she can say that now because, like, now she's rich, so it's okay. She doesn't need to be doing interior design.
Yeah.
People were mad. And I did a show about her around when things were really divisive in Canada around Freedom Convoy and around all these influencers lending their support for Freedom Convoy. We did a show on Jillian Harris, who was against Freedom Convoy, which was refreshing. And it was a big take for someone who's in the hot seat in her position.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, the sentiment around the people that listen to my show and around the people that follow my Instagram was that she is pretty beloved because of the community that she built. So she, you know, kind of brings people together. She sells something called the Jilly Box, which is a subscription box. Mm-hmm. She launched it during COVID and the website like crashed because 60,000 people logged on to like buy it. And I think at the time she had said they've only ever sold 5,000 of anything. So that's all they had ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's one of the people that, you know how some people really took a step back during COVID and they did really poorly. Other people moved ahead and she had a bit of like a big leapfrog ahead during COVID.
Yeah.
It really kind of was good for her financially and for her growth. But she took to her Instagram about a month ago to complain about a Reddit snark subreddit that was devoted to her. And in doing so, she's now alerted her 1.4 million followers that there's a Reddit snark page about me. And even if you're a huge fan of hers, you're probably curious.
Right. Totally.
So that Reddit page has now grown like exponentially.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is what she intended.
Right.
And there's a ton of gross stuff on there that would be more like GOMI-esque. Like there's a lot of like, you know, I think the below the belt stuff is so, I think it's gross. Don't talk about people's marriage. Don't talk about their kids. Don't talk about whether they're a good mother or not.
Right.
I think you can take a look at someone's work when it's public and say, I feel like, you know, the quality is going down, or I feel like it's too much consumerism, or for me, I feel like it's less authenticity. And I feel like there is real valuable feedback buried in those sometimes gross threads where it's almost like free market research. Like you can take that and kind of like use it and, you know, sit with it a bit and use it to like make your brand stronger.
Yeah.
I don't think she's there yet. I think she's still, I don't know if I would be mad or flattered if I had a snark page. I guess I would have felt like, oh, I made it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I've made it. Mm-hmm. But you know, so now there's like the sentiment where people really loved her, and now the tide might be changing. I don't know. We'll see. And you talk about how we want our momfluencers to be authentic, but we don't want them to get paid too much for being authentic. And we seem to sort of struggle with that. Our relationship with momfluencers seems to be complicated. Like, perform for me, mm-hmm. but don't get paid for it. So mm-hmm. how do we reconcile that within ourselves? Oh. I know that's a big question.
No, yeah. But it's an important one. And yeah, we demand vulnerability from our momfluencers in a way that I think can be really icky, for lack of a better word. I don't think we should crave seeing a stranger cry on camera to yeah. feel a sense of connection to that person. But yeah, I think we have to ask ourselves as consumers, what are we trying to get from this interaction, even though it's a one-sided interaction? Are we trying to learn something specific about motherhood? Like, maybe we're looking for, I don't know, snack tips for a kid with sensory processing stuff, you know? In which case, that's a really practical application of momfluencer culture and really specific. Maybe we have experienced pregnancy loss and we are looking for validation and community. Again, really specific. Maybe we're looking for home decor inspiration. Like, all of these things are completely valid and fine. And maybe we're just wanting, you know, popcorn entertainment, and we just want to turn our brains off and relax at the end of the day. But if the content is not providing relaxation, and we're going to it for that, I think we just need to do vibe checks with ourselves.
If it makes you feel gross,
right,
you can unfollow.
Right. You know? If it makes you feel gross in any way, I think that's a great place to stop and, you know, ask yourself some questions. I think just to be clear about what we're hoping to find and what we don't want to find online. Because, like, these things, we can't unsee them. I always think about, my mother always used to say when I was little, like, if you watch a horror movie, just remember, like, you won't be able to get it out of your brain. Like, it's there. And, you know, that's completely true with anything we consume online. Yeah,
my own complicated relationship with that is that I think influencing, well, certainly momfluencing, is one of the very few spaces where women out-earn men.
Yeah.
I don't know the step. Like, it has to be. I haven't read a study, but, like, it must be. And so it's like, why do we want to punish these people for finding both flexibility within their work and a way to monetize the labor of motherhood, which is largely, like, invisible and unseen and underappreciated? So it's like, I kind of, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like, for me, it's cyclical. Like, I get annoyed and I'm like, I don't really follow many people anyway. But then sometimes I'm like, these people are just trying to make a living. And,
totally.
You know, so I struggle with that a bit. And I think there's this kind of underlying notion that their job is so easy. They're just taking a photo of their kid and talking about their day, and then they post it and they get paid a ton of money. And in reality, you talk about in your book how there's a very small group of influencers, of momfluencers, that make a good amount of money.
Yep.
It's a lot of hard work. Like, these photo shoots, setting up brand deals, these are businesses.
Right.
It's like video shoots, right? Like, a ton of work actually goes into this. And there is a massive pay disparity between your traditional, like, white, you know, wealthy
right.
momfluencer and basically everybody else.
Right. Totally.
It's not all equal, right?
So. No, not at all. And there's no real oversight. There's no industry standards, you know, there's no HR department. I think when people get hot and bothered about the money aspect of it, it helps to think of just supporting a mother's small business rather than, I think it gets tricky when we think about, like, they're getting paid for the unpaid labor of motherhood, because I don't think they are. I think they're getting paid for their, you know, keen aesthetic eye, for their ability to create a really cohesive aesthetic, for their marketing skills, for their business skills, for their editing skills, for their writing skills. Like, that's what we're paying them for. The same way, you know, if we're going to click on an affiliate link from Coca-Cola, like, that money is going to Coca-Cola. So, like, why not give, you know, if I'm going to buy vitamins anyway, why not use a momfluencer who I respect as far as I know? Why not use her affiliate link and she'll get whatever commission? I think it's highly, you know, a lot of internalized misogyny is happening there when we get cranky about them being paid. And I think if we just stopped thinking about them as being paid for motherhood and instead viewed them as being paid for essentially advertising and marketing, we might be able to feel, you know, less conflicted about it.
Yeah, that's such a great point. I think ultimately, when we've spoken about influencers on the podcast before, the conclusion we always come to is, if it's not for you, just simply don't support them financially. And if it makes you feel bad, just unfollow them. As consumers and as followers and as viewers and as voyeurs, really, like, watching their lives, we also have a responsibility. You know, we can kind of control what we're watching to some degree. We can't control what we're absorbing from everywhere, you know? Rompers are a big thing in Vancouver. So, like, you'll walk down the street and there's, like, half the moms with, like, their strollers or are in, like, you know, the same kind of romper. Like, you can't control where you're getting it from on the outside, but you can control, like, the media that you're watching. And momfluencing isn't new. You bring up this great anecdote. I didn't know this, about how Betty Crocker, I guess, was, like, they'd hired an actress to go on these shows and do, like, these talk show circuits.
There were several. There were various women who portrayed her.
Yeah, so it's like momfluencing has existed, like, has it existed since motherhood existed? So since the beginning of time, but just in whatever medium was available to us at the time?
I think, you know, as soon as we could represent motherhood in any sort of medium, you could argue that for sure.
What is with our, like, why do we want to watch, like, this domestic bliss, like the depiction of the perfect domestic life, whether it was like watching Leave It to Beaver back in like the 50s or 60s or whenever that show was on, to watching these perfect Instagram squares now, to watching Nara Smith bake these beautiful little Cheerios, you know, at 5 a.m. Like, what is with our need to be watching that? Why do we do that to ourselves?
I think in many cases we've been conditioned to sort of seek out meaning, and the stories many of us have been told growing up are stories about motherhood and family and marriage and domesticity. So I think our brains are just hardwired to view these narratives as, like, quote unquote, the right narratives. And I think when humans, you know, read a story in which they are familiar with, there's a certain, okay, all is right with the world. My existential dread about the climate crisis and the, you know, scary political agendas across the world and, you know, the horrific situation in Gaza. Like, I can put all of that somewhere else and watch somebody make tiny Cheerios.
Yeah,
I think it is in many ways like a coping mechanism to just the horrors of modern life.
You put it really interestingly in your book. I think you had said something like, I'm summarizing, but it's easier to digest watching someone make themselves like a water or hot water with lemon than it is to grapple with like the state of reproductive rights for women in the U.S. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like there's so little big things that we can control over motherhood that but we can go and click on an affiliate link and buy our kid a gender neutral or like a, you know, neutral palette colored onesie, or as you had put it in one section, I guess you had bought a wicker laundry basket and it gives you like a hit of dopamine, like, well, I'm doing, you know what I mean? Like, I'm doing something, and you know that it's not solving any like real big issues, but for like within that moment, you're like, well, I'll have a nice laundry basket, right? And and the other aha moment for me was kind of around the self-care piece, which self-care is, you know, it's not just buying the affiliate link that's going to buy the bubble bath that someone is recommending. It might make you feel good taking the bath because it's nice, but real self-care is like access to childcare. Mm-hmm. It is mm-hmm. access to community. It's having a library nearby you with like a story time and being able to connect with other parents.
Yep.
But those are issues that are so big for us to grapple with. We tend to, you know, gravitate towards the things that we can easily access.
Well, and also those things are intrinsically connected to other human beings, whereas shopping for a laundry basket is solely about me and my insular nuclear family. And again, of course, depending on culture and context and upbringing, I think in capitalism, we are trained to, you know, really prioritize self-optimization and family optimization, and not worry too much about, you know, collective action and creating community and ensuring that all people have access to safe, joyful, meaningful lives. So I think that's like really very much a function of capitalism and something to deliberately resist.
Yeah, I think that, and the self-optimization piece, I remember you talking about that around Rachel Hollis. And I think most people listening to this would know who Rachel Hollis is, but she's an American influencer who wrote Girl, Wash Your Face. And she had, around COVID, gone on this like tirade. She did like this self like soliloquy about like, I don't care about being relatable because I wake up at 5 a.m. and I work so hard so that I can pay someone to come clean my toilets. Uh-huh. And obviously she got a lot of backlash from that. And in your book, you talk about like her toxic positivity. And we have a lot of that in Vancouver as well, where it's like, just wake up at 5 a.m. and meditate and make yourself like a matcha latte. And it's like, dude, not everybody can do this. And there's a ton of people who wake up at 3 a.m.
Right.
And they're working 14 hours
right.
just to get by. So, you know, you talking about kind of like the self-optimization that comes at the price of like essentially marginalized communities, right? It's like
totally.
Boosting oneself and people that look like you
right.
at a price to others. So
totally. Yeah.
Your book is so important.
Oh, thank you.
I need everyone to read it. I don't recommend books lightly. The last book I recommended before this was Fourth Wing because I'm like deep in my dragon era. Have you gotten into this stuff? Like
no.
ACOTAR, Fourth
oh,
Wing?
Oh, I haven't yet.
Oh, you know, Sarah.
I know the phenomenon, but I have not dabbled.
You might find like there has to be some intersection with motherhood there. Like why? we're gravitating so hard towards these books. I am like so fascinated by the tradwife stuff that you guys have going on in the States. And I actually have a question around that because I remember when Blake Lively did her Preserve website.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a lot. It was like, I don't remember the year, but I want to say like 2014-ish.
Ish. Yeah. That's
in and
right.
around that time. And she got like eviscerated because she did this story around, it was called like The Allure of Antebellum. And
oh, God.
Like she was romanticizing,
oh God,
like a time in the U.S. Yeah, where
yeah.
you know, if you were Caucasian and you had money, you were like on top, and if you yeah. weren't that, you were, you know, there's always a winner and a loser. And anyways, her website, she shut it down and it went nowhere. And but now there's like this rise of trad wives, and they're very popular. Like Ballerina Farm is very popular. And I'm curious, what do you think has changed? Like back then, however many years ago it was, it didn't fly. Like you guys shut it down. You guys were like, no. And now you guys are like, I'm saying you guys like as a collective,
right.
but just because
right,
she
right.
has like millions of followers.
Yeah.
Now it's like, yes. Has something changed? And if so, what has changed?
I mean, I think, you know, after the pandemic, during the pandemic, a lot of women were radicalized in ways that they hadn't been before, particularly privileged women, because, you know, all of their outsourced, and by they, I mean me as well.
Yeah.
You know, childcare was shut down, education was shut down. All of these people, so many of us relied on to make our lives work, you know, we had no access to that level of support and community. And so, yeah, I think a lot of women and mothers gained new language about sort of the broken state of maternity in the US. And I think there's always backlash to social progress. So, you know, a lot of these trad accounts will say, like, there's an attack on the nuclear family, and really position themselves in the defensive, which is nonsense, of course. But I think that's a tactic the right often uses, paints themselves as the victim and standing up for the little guy, when in fact, they're almost always the big guy.
They're like great at marketing. Like
they're really, really good.
The words, the fear that they're able to leverage.
Yes.
We don't have the same fear kind of media that you guys have. Ours is a little less.
Yeah.
But we also have our own problems. So
like, yeah, totally.
Not trying to act like we're like we have it all together over here. And you also speak a lot about like the anxiety that people face with like these social comparisons, right? Like most of us are not able to live the same kind of lives as these momfluencers that we follow. And yet we still want to consume the content and then we turn it off and we feel kind of like worse about ourselves. And you also bring up these mirror neurons, which I thought was such a good point. Because, and maybe you can speak a little bit more about what mirror neurons are, but I thought it was so funny when you were like, you watch it and then, but you would just rather go like vacuum up the Cheeto dust. I'm like, oh, me too. I would rather also like wash the dishes than make Play-Doh with my kid.
Okay. So yeah, the mirror neurons?
Neurons?
Yes. Are so fascinating to me. And obviously I am not a scientist and know very little about the actual workings of these things, but essentially I talked to a psychiatrist who told me about how they studied phantom limb syndrome. Do you know this? So say,
So
say you have lost your right arm in an accident. You can feel like itching sensations or burning sensations. You can just feel sensations in an arm that is no longer there. And to treat this, they basically held a mirror up, had a person, you know, held the mirror up in such a way that the person would itch the missing arm and it looked, again, you know, they held the mirror in such a way where when they did the itching, it felt as though they were itching the missing arm.
It was like the satisfaction.
Yes. Because of the way the mirror was held, they looked in and said, oh, here I am itching my right arm, when in fact they're, you know. But yeah, so she posited that when we are viewing a momfluencer's, you know, beautiful newborn photos or a photo of her reading to her children in like, you know, a tent with fairy lights, or we're watching her cut up carrots with her kiddo and it just looks beautiful and wholesome, that we sort of walk away feeling as though, because we viewed these images as lovely and wholesome and laudatory, that we sort of can check off the box of being like a good, wholesome, nurturing mother because we're viewing that type of content. And yeah, I thought that was a really, really fascinating point. Like, because I saw this and clocked it as good, I'm also good and don't need to worry about implementing it in my own life. And of course, I don't think it's that, you know, black and white, or, but I think there's something to it.
Totally. And I also think, you know, you make so many good points in your book about the people that are kind of like the tastemakers, like the people that show us like, well, this is what good motherhood is. And it is like typically like your wealthy white, you know, people of like who we give like this influence to. And so our internal depiction of good motherhood is like a reflection of what they're telling us it is, because they're like the woman in power. And like, that's a whole other, it's a whole other can of worms.
Totally.
I know you have to go. So can you just tell us like where we can find you? And the book is Momfluenced: Inside the Maddening Picture Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. I'm going to do a giveaway on my podcast.
Cool.
It's in paperback now. So I'm going to send it to some of my Canadian friends. I could talk to you forever. And I want you to also say like, your book meant a lot to me personally. I think it was brilliant. And I'm not like saying that lightly. I love your Substack. So please tell us, where can we find more of you, Sarah?
Thank you so much. Best place is my Substack, which is In Pursuit of Clean Countertops. I write about bad Instagram ads. I write about, you know, the cult of ideal motherhood, and I do deep dives on momfluencers that may or may not be maddening for you. Yeah, I'm on Instagram as well when I have to be. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It was such a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much for making the time 1.5 years after we were supposed to originally do this.
Better late than never.
Loved it. Thank you. Hey, that's the show. Thanks so much for tuning in. For real, you took the time and that means a lot. If you like the show, please share with your friends, subscribe, and give us 5 stars to show your support wherever you get your podcasts. If you want more interaction, join the Instagram page at Have You Heard Podcast, where there's lots of pop culture analysis and behind the scenes highlights of how shows are formed, which you, dear listener, are a part of. Until next time.